So let me just introduce you. Tom Ackerman is going to speak on climate change, climate engineering, and the global hydrologic cycle. And thank you. Take that away.
Thank you, Dorothy.
This talk should be imagined as we're all looking at a giant pile of water, and I'm skipping rocks across the top because I'm just going to hop from a topic to a topic.
It's also going to be a little different than Dorothy's because I'm a physicist. I'm not a biologist. I like equations. I know that's a little scary, but there you are. So why do I care so much about water? It's interesting. This talk, to some extent, captures a lot of the stuff that I've done over my career. Well, water's vital for life, but that's the biology piece, so we'll just set that aside. Water's the most important greenhouse gas in our atmosphere. It's the most important greenhouse gas because it has this incredibly rich absorption spectrum, which comes about because the molecule is asymmetric. And if that sounds like a bunch of chemistry, it is, but it's great stuff. If it wasn't for water vapor, our atmosphere would not have the warming potential that it does. And we would all be a lot unhappier living here. Water vapor has a very large heat capacity as a liquid. Why do we care about that? Because it actually buffers the seasonal change. Bodies of water like the ocean, like the Great Lakes, actually modify what would be happening. And if you don't know the difference, just think about the difference of winter in North Dakota and in Michigan. They're the same latitude, but winter in Michigan's a lot different than winter in North Dakota. And it's very large latent heat. It takes a lot of energy to evaporate water. When we take that evaporated water from the tropics and we move it towards the poles, we're not just moving water vapor, we're moving energy, because when that water vapor condenses, it releases that latent heat locally and heats the atmosphere in further latitudes. It also cleanses the atmosphere because it collects bad gases and particles. We all know that. Air looks wonderful after a good rainstorm, right? So it's a way that our atmosphere cleanses itself. And finally, the vapor concentration in the tropics are something like 50 to 100 times greater than the concentrations at the pole. I always like to baffle my students by suggesting to them, if I took all the water in the column over our head in the atmosphere right now and condensed it down on the ground, how thick would that layer be? Anybody want to take a guess? We're in Golden, Colorado. We're 5,000 feet high. I didn't do the calculation this morning, but you'd be lucky if you get a centimeter. If you're in the deep tropics, you get 6. If you're up in Barrow, Alaska, in the middle of winter, you're somewhere less than 0.01. And that's all we're talking about. If you think about the water that's in those clouds out there right now, if the whole column is a centimeter, the amount that's in those clouds outside is a fraction of a millimeter or a few millimeters. That's all. It's this little skin of stuff that's driving our whole climate. Okay, global hydrologic cycle. You all know all these processes already, evaporation, condensation, precipitation, you know, all these nice big words. Over on the, whatever side that is, I'm not good with left and right, you'll have to just accept that side. The ocean is 97.6%, the land is 2.4%, and almost all of that land water is tied up in Greenland and Antarctica and ice sheets. And the atmosphere is that 0.01 that doesn't even register on the one digits. This kind of thing here, where we're having to transport, that's what I was just talking about, you're moving energy as well as you're moving water. We can actually measure this stuff better than we ever have been able to before. And this is something which Dorothy said one of her slides could be a whole lecture. This slide right here and its neighboring friends and relatives could be a whole lecture all by itself. These are measurements that are made by a radar in space. Unfortunately, we had to throw that radar in space into the ocean, because it ran out of fuel to keep it aloft, but we've replaced it. This is a map that shows over here, is a units of millimeter a day, don't worry about it, just look at the sort of relative units. And we see these regions of very heavy rain, precipitation in the tropics. We also see these regions of relatively little rain. The great deserts of the world are not only great deserts on land, they are great deserts in the ocean as well, which may sound odd, but there's no rain in those latitudes. If we simply look at a place like the United States, we have places in the United States that get less than 5 inches of rain a year. We have places that get on the order of 100 inches, and we have places up, you know, in my neighborhood that exceed 200 inches, 400 inches a year. So there's an order of magnitude just across the United States. This is one of the things that makes hydrology such a nuisance for a climate scientist who wants to look at the globe. All right, because you've got orders of magnitude that you're fighting with all the time. It's not just a difference of 2, it's a difference of 10 or 100. Okay, so one of the things, if you saw Catherine's talk this morning, she put up this wiggly graph with a line through it, and she said, that's the way we think about hydrology. The problem is, we're not on that line anymore, we're on this line. We're on a line where the capacity of the atmosphere to take up water is going up because it's warmer. So how do we think about what the future will look like? Well, we do it with climate models. Climate models have both a good and a bad name, depending on who wants to use them for what. So we build a climate model. These are the most sophisticated pieces of computer code that my business knows how to make. They are based on fundamental physical equations, fluid dynamical equations. Embedded in there is a lot of nasty physics about radiative transfer, which is what I do, about clouds, which is also what I do, about the whole process of hydrology, as well as land surface processes. These are complicated beasts, and yet they are less complicated than the world in which we live. So what do? We build this model, we compare it to data, like the data I just showed you. And we continue to cycle through this process of comparing data, of making our model better, comparing it to data, and trying always to improve what we have. Well, we take what we have, and we apply a scenario. And I'll talk a little bit about what I mean by a scenario in a minute. We run the global model forward for 100 years, or in some results I'm going to show you 200 years. We're not shy. After all, you know, the good thing about climate, I can't tell you what the weather's going to do tomorrow. I can tell you what's going to happen 20 years from now, and then, you know, we'll have to wait and find out if I'm right. We compare results from multiple models, and there's a reason for this. We have a little more confidence in our results if we have multiple models from around the world that are producing the same answer. And then finally, we often, particularly in case of water, we then take this output from these large-scale global models, and we use it to run much higher resolution models over limited domains. This is a critically important kind of technique for places like where I live in the Northwest, where you've got huge terrain variations that the large model can't actually capture. Okay, so when we do that, we need these scenarios. Well, scenarios are changes in greenhouse gas concentrations and other things, but just focus on greenhouse gas concentration, based on assumed changes in energy use and consumption. All right? They are not meant to be predictive. I'm not trying to tell you how the world's going to evolve in the next 50 years. I'm saying there's a couple of plausible tracks I can think about, and these are illustrative of what's going to happen. All right? Now, if you want a biblical analogy for this, you know, we talk about the prophets predicting things. They didn't actually know what was going to happen. It's sort of, if you keep doing this, then that's what's going to happen. All right? We're a little bit like those guys. All right? If we don't quit doing what you're doing, this is what's going to happen. So they're meant to be illustrative. There are two scenarios that I'm going to show here at various places. One's called RCP 8.5. Don't worry about what that means. I could tell you, but we'd all be bored, including me. And RCP 2.6. The difference is 8.5 is what we call business as usual. It assumes that whatever we're doing now in terms of growth and in terms of how people are using resources will continue at roughly that same rate. And it includes population growth. So it includes that factor you were just raising. The 2.6 assumes a substantial reduction, and I mean a substantial reduction, in the use of fossil fuels. It's greater than what we agreed to in the Paris Accord. Or used to agree to, or however I should. Okay, so again, here's a slide that we could spend, you know, a good hour talking about what happens when we do these projections. So here's the rapid emissions reductions. These are precipitation changes in percentages. The reason that they're given in percentages is because if you give them an absolute, the only thing you see is the wet places, right? Because those are the huge changes that occur. You can see these wet belts that I pointed out in the tropics before are increasing. These dry zones that I pointed out before are decreasing. If we look over here at the business as usual one, you can see 20-30% differences in the tropical rainfall, but you can see minus 20 and minus 30% increases in the dry areas. This is a consensus of what our models tell us. And we, you know, being scientists, we like to use big words, so we say the wet gets wetter and the dry gets drier. All right, so what do we know about hydrologic changes? Increasing greenhouse gas concentrations produce a warmer climate. Because the air is warmer, we get more water, we enhance the water cycle. Then the wet places get wetter and the dry places get drier because we're cranking the same cycle, but we're cranking it harder. We're driving it harder. That tends to narrow down the wet places, make them more intense, and broaden out the dry places. There's a tendency then to do two things. One is to increase drought, and the other is to make more intense rain. And we already have statistics that the intensity of rainfall is increasing. We have more intense rainstorms now, and not just hurricanes that are showing up all the time because the air is warmer. For those of us who live out west, there's a big problem that snowpacks are decreasing. And snowpacks will continue to decrease because as you warm the column of air, the transition point between water and snow goes up. And if you live in a place like the Washington, where the Cascades are only about 7,000 feet high, you're starting to push up towards the point where there's not enough area anymore to put snow on. So all of this is going to lead to increased competition for water resources. Okay, so now let's think about something totally different. In a talk this morning, Catherine quoted John Holmgren about mitigation, adaptation, and suffering. All right, well, I did put suffering on my slide, but I do have mitigation, I do have adaptation, but there's something new in the middle. We can think about the world in which we live right now as collective human actions causing climate change, are causing changes to the climate system, they affect the climate system, and then there are consequent impacts. The way we think about this is, okay, mitigation means get at it and try and fix the problem before it occurs. Adaptation means try and live with what happens. Geoengineering or climate engineering is the weird idea that, well, if we know how to warm up the place, we might know how to cool it down. Okay, so what if we try to manage climate? What if we tried to do something about engineering climate? You may think this is a little weird. I think this is a little weird, but it's okay. Somebody's got to think about it. And I'm good at weird stuff, so there you go. This is solar climate engineering. It's an attempt to think of ways in which we could modify our climate. We can have a lovely talk about this, making reflective aerosols that mimic what happens with a volcano, changing the way in which marine clouds work over the ocean to make them brighter and more reflective, or putting little mirrors in space. When I actually give this longer talk on how we might geoengineer the world, I also have a slide of Archimedes moving the planet a little further away from the sun. Okay, so I'm now, this is the next four slides or so are the technical part. All of this has been easy so far. Now come the technical part. We ran, and of course all professors say we, you know, collectively, because it's actually my colleague at PNNL and my graduate student who did all the work. I just looked at the graphs. Okay, so what we did was we did a bunch of scenarios, and we did two kinds of scenarios. One is we allowed CO2 to increase in the model. The other is we allowed CO2 to increase, but at the same time we dialed down the sun. We just turned down the amount of sun reaching the planet. And you can go, that's cheating, and I will tell you, yes, it's cheating, but it's easy. And easy is good, especially when you're thinking about weird stuff. We allowed CO2 to increase at 1% a year, and then we did a run where it leveled off, and that was roughly a doubling of CO2, a little more. Then we did another one where we allowed it to plateau, and we then started taking CO2 out. So this is the idea that we would figure out how to remove CO2 from our atmosphere using some kinds of biology and some kinds of chemical scrubbing. Down here, we had two scenarios where we turned down the sun to compensate for these increasing amounts of CO2 forcing. So this is the cooling side, this is the warming side, and we did two different scenarios, and I'll show you why in a moment. Okay, so here's a couple of messy diagrams. Let me walk you through the first one so you'll recognize what's going on. We started all of our model runs in the year 2000. So we started them from a computer simulation that's capturing 2000, and we ran it for 200 years. The black line is what we get if we simply just allowed the CO2 concentration in 2000 to remain. And you can see the planet wants to warm up, and that's because there's residual warming in the planet that we haven't yet resolved. The brown one here, this dark brownish one, is the one where we applied the strong solar dimming. We turned down the sun, and you can see that, at least in our model, we can regulate the temperature. We can balance these two forces and make the temperatures stay steady. This is the in-between one, and this is the CO2 one. So when we just allow the CO2 to ramp up, and then we ramp it down, the system tries to recover. There's a hysteresis in it. It doesn't follow the same track back that it followed up, and that's because there's residual warming that has occurred in the system, and there's a time scale associated with the ocean. You can't get rid of it. Okay, so remember, there's one where the temperature is about the same, there's one where it's kind of in-between, and there's one where it's going up with CO2. All right, so the other thing I want to point out is that in all of these scenarios, in all of these runs, the Arctic always warms more than the tropics. It's called Arctic amplification. I can point you to a whole bunch of interesting papers, well, at least they're interesting to me, on why this occurs. But the easiest way to think about it is that the tropical atmosphere is really opaque already. There's lots of water vapor there. And so adding a little bit of CO2 doesn't do much to change that downward flux. The Arctic is very dry, so adding a little bit of CO2 and a little bit of water vapor makes a lot more difference. Okay, now I want to take to global precipitation, because that's what this talk is about, right? Water. Yeah, I know. I'm talking fast. I'm going. Okay, so here's the line where we didn't do anything. Here's the strong solar forcing, and here's the weak solar forcing. So now you can understand why we tried two different amounts of solar forcing. When we turn on the sun, turn down the sun to try and balance the temperature, the hydrologic cycle slowed up a lot. So we said, well, is there some happy medium where we can turn it up, you know, turn it down a little bit, but not enough to screw up the water? And that's sort of this red line. You'll notice that in the CO2 runs, the water cycle accelerates. And that's exactly what I said earlier. You're warming the planet, and therefore it must accelerate. Okay, so why does it turn down? Well, here's balance of two big heat fluxes. This is the amount of solar radiation being absorbed at the surface of the planet. And you can see this big decrease where we turn down the sun, going from, you know, a number like 160 watts per square meter down to 157. And that doesn't sound like a big change, but trust me, a few watts per square meter integrated over 200 years is a lot of energy. Okay, so here's the latent heat flux. This is evaporation from the ocean. Turns out that when you turn down the sun, the ocean doesn't decrease its temperature, it just quits evaporating water. And so the whole cycle slows down, because if you don't evaporate, you can't precipitate. And one of my colleagues and I have had a bunch of, you would find them pretty humorous arguments about, you know, how we explain this, and I'm the simple-minded person. I say, if it doesn't evaporate, you can't rain. You know, it's real easy. But there's a lot more complicated physics going on in here than what I'm actually giving to you. So our attempt here, again, with this intermediate forcing, you can see that the latent heat flux still wants to respond to this turning up and down the solar radiation. So this is an indication that 70% of our planet is covered by water. And even though we care about the water on land, as a climate person, I care about the water over. All right. So I'm going to skip that because I want to talk about this for my last 3 minutes. If you're going to talk about geoengineering, you don't get to talk just about geoengineering. You get to talk about geoengineering, you get to talk about ethics, and you get to talk about governance. And the way I think about this problem in simple-minded terms is the science question is, can we do it? And often scientists get really enthused about the can we do it, and they forget this question over here, which is the ethical question of just because we can do it, should we do it? And then there's this other question associated with this, how do we do it? All right, so all of these are linked together. Science is tied to ethics. Just because we can do something doesn't mean we should. Science is tied to governance. If I start talking about geoengineering the planet, there's probably a few people who would want to know who's in control of this little experiment you're talking about doing. And some of you might even think it's not a great idea. Trust me, I don't think it's a great idea either. We can come back to that. Ethics is then tied to the science because there's different ethical arguments about doing the process studies to figure out if this can be done, doing the testing that you would need to know how to do it, and then actually deploying it. My group and I have just published an article on this idea of what are the ethics behind large-scale testing. And in a weak moment, I agreed to teach a class with an ethicist. So a professor of philosophy and I co-taught a class on the campus of the University of Washington on the science and ethics of geoengineering. Any of you who've taught know that you get these reviews at the end, right? My department chair walked into my office after the reviews came to his office, and he said, I don't know what you guys did, but I've never seen reviews that good. The students loved it, and they loved it because we were pushing on something that neither one of us fully understand. And we're saying to the graduate students, you know, we're all in this together. So I just want to raise some of these issues. I've thought about them. I've written about some of them. My colleague Steve Gardner and I have argued about them. So there's the idea of intent. Is it more wrong to try and engineer the climate if I already know I'm engineering the climate as a side effect? Is there a moral hazard by offering people an opportunity to not have the planet warm up by solar climate engineering? Do I stop them from doing what they really should be doing? There's a lesser of two evils, which is the one we can get into giant arguments about. Let's suppose that both of these processes, warming up the planet by CO2 is evil, and doing geoengineering is evil in some abstract sense. Which is more evil? Am I allowed to do something evil if I'm avoiding something less evil? If your head's starting to hurt, that's what happens when you tangle with deficits. Tragedy and disproportionate effects, and this came up in one of the question, your question. The people who are responsible for the problem, that's this little graph down here, by the way, the people in the blue are the people who are responsible for the problem, and the people in the red are the people who are going to suffer. And then there's a whole issue of justice for future generations. What are we leaving to our children and to our grandchildren? I now got grandchildren. It's pretty cool. But what am I leaving them, and how do I view that in terms of an ethical response? And finally, there's this issue of governance. Who makes the decisions if we decide to do this, and how would we? So some thoughts for you to ponder. Increasing global temperature is certainly going to change the hydrologic cycle. Some of these effects are predictable on the large scale. The ones on the small scale are a lot less predictable, and we didn't have a chance to talk about that. Changing water availability will lead to competition among societal values. We see this in the Northwest. Is hydropower more important than irrigation or more important than salmon? Because they all want the same water. They want it at different times and they want it at different temperatures. And we're running out. That's going to generate conflict. So geoengineering offers the possibility of preventing these shifts, but it raises some really difficult questions. And finally, the Christian community should be playing a role in this, and yet we're largely absent from these discussions, and I think that's truly unfortunate. Thank you.
Tom has time for several questions.
Mm-hmm. A question about aerosols and clouds.
Yes.
Judging by the IPCC report, that's one of the biggest areas of uncertainty.
Oh, she just wiped out my picture. Oh,
sorry.
Put that picture up, just for a minute.
But my question is, how big is the uncertainty, and is there anything you can do to reduce
Thursday evening, I was at something called the Gordon Research Conference. I gave a 40-minute talk on aerosols and clouds and how you would geoengineer and what we don't know. So how long do we have?
Way down the end. No, you got to go back up a ways. You got to go right down up there. Keep going down. Down. There. All right. See those lines in the clouds? Those are ship tracks. Those are ships sailing underneath the cloud, releasing stuff into the cloud, and changing the brightness of that cloud. And we know that happens. I can show you dozens and dozens of pictures. We don't know the processes. We don't understand how. So I can give you the hand-wavy thing about how they occur, but the details, I don't know. So, yes, we're working on that, and it's a problem that's of real interest to me. Yeah, way in the back.
What about increasing the reflectivity of rooftops and other simple structures?
Yeah. So the problem is 70% of the planet is covered by water. There's a huge part of the land that has no structure on it, and a lot of our fields that we don't actually want to paint. So if you do the back of the envelope calculation of how much additional reflectivity you're going to get from changing rooftops and stuff like that, globally it doesn't buy you anything. It might buy you something locally because many cities, as we know, have a hot spot. They're relatively warm compared to their surroundings, largely because they have no water to evaporate. So there's some gain to be had by putting in rooftop gardens by painting things white instead of black. But it's not going to solve the big problem.
Yeah, do you think there's danger in talking about solar solutions as though they're solutions when they just solve the temperature problem and they do nothing about the ocean acidity?
Absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, again, given a little more time, I would have started out with the problem of ocean acidification as part of the CO2 problem. This is only a temporary step. All right? You can only do this for a little while. And you don't solve all the problems. So view solar climate engineering as sort of a stopgap, kind of putting your finger in the dike while you're building a better dike, because there are problems we will never get around, and we certainly ought to be thinking about them. Thank you for bringing that up. I should have said that earlier. Sure.
Well, that relates to a question I had, which had we've seen global dimming in the areas with the atmospheric ground clouds where there's so much smog that the surface of the earth has actually been dimmed, and it's affected a lot of crops, especially in Asia. So is there some concern that while global dimming might lower global temperature, that it would actually harm crops?
So you can have it both ways. Oh. If you do it too, you know, it's like half or everything in moderation. If you do too much of this, then you start reducing the total solar availability. And a lot of the problem, I think, in places where the brown cloud is the bad smog that's attacking the crops. If you do a little bit of this, a lot of plants actually like it because it creates more diffuse radiation. If you have a lot of direct radiation, plant leaves shield other plant leaves. Yeah. So you actually get better results if you have diffuse radiation. At least that's what the models say. All right, I think I
should. Any other questions? Okay, thank you so much.